I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Do you know how the Supreme Court ruled on health care? It was easy to get confused given that both Fox News and CNN reported that it had been overturned. But even 2 weeks later, 45% of Americans still don't know whether the Affordable Care Act was overturned or upheld. On today's broadcast, the media critics are back with a look at the news that's been scorching the headlines, plus a look at talking politics in the workplace. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. CNN's Anderson Cooper is a big-time media personality, and he's gay. Was he obligated to come out and tell the rest of the world that? Speaking of CNN, the network blew it a couple of weeks back when the U.S. Supreme Court released its ruling on President Obama's Health Care Act. At first, the network reported that the individual mandate had been tossed out. Turns out, of course, that wasn't the case. We'll talk with our media critics this morning about what went wrong and why. Later on this hour, talking politics in the workplace, something that will be going on more than just a little bit in the KC area this election year. What's allowed, what's not, we'll find out. But first up, our media critics. They are Kansas City Star Readers Rep Derek Donovan. He's the Star's ombudsman. Derek, always good to have you.
Same to you. Good morning. Good to be here, yeah.
KU Journalism Professor Mike Williams is also back with us. Mike, thanks for taking the trip.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And KCUR Sylvia Maria Gross is also here. She is host and producer of KC Currents, heard here on Sunday afternoons at 5. Sylvia, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's begin with CNN's Anderson Cooper. On July 2nd, it was reported to have said, "The fact is, I'm gay." Mike, maybe I'm missing something here, but why is this news? Why does anybody care?
I think it's news because he's decided to make it news. You know, it's one of those things that why do you come out if you have no other reason than to say in public that you're gay? Clearly, he had some reason that he wanted to get that out there, and so he chose to do it. I think "so what" kind of comes to mind, but
yeah.
But he chose to do it, and so he made a little splash for a while, and that's that.
Well, Sylvia, it just makes me wonder, aren't we far enough along in our evolution as a society that maybe this kind of pronouncement isn't necessary any longer, or am I just wrong about that?
Well, I think that might be the case. I mean, but with President Obama's announcement that his opinion has evolved about gay marriage, I just think it's interesting that use of the word "evolve" that I've heard from a number of politicians and just in American society, there's the idea that public opinion has changed about gay marriage and I guess acceptance of gays and lesbians in society. And I don't know whether this recent kind of spate of announcements that people are gay are part of that, but part of just an acceptance of it in the workplace in a very public way.
Mm-hmm. Derek, you wonder, did he have an obligation to come out and say something? You know, some folks in the gay community say he's obligated to say that given who he is, as Mike Williams just pointed out. Did he have an obligation here or not?
I think that people are going to vary on that. One of the things that mainstream audiences might not really be aware of is he has been under intense scrutiny from the gay press for a long time. They have felt he's really never made any secret about it in his personal life. And if you've ever ever watched any of the tabloid coverage of his personal life, it's always been very clear that he's been living as a gay man for his entire adulhood.
So it has been clear in some circles, I guess.
Okay. Absolutely. And Out magazine famously put a photo illustration of him and Jodie Foster on the cover of an issue a couple years ago about the glass closet. And, you know, basically saying, look, these are two of the highest profile gay people in America. And I think you could argue that Anderson's among the most high profile journalists, period. And one of the things that he said in his statement, which, by the way, he released to his friend Andrew Sullivan, who is a very influential gay commentator and blogger, is that he never really meant to hide anything, but he realizes that some people realize after so long, especially with the introduction of his talk show, which is making him more of a personality even than a reporter, that it appears that he was embarrassed or ashamed, and so he regretted that it had taken him so long to get to that point.
So Jodie Foster's gay? I didn't know that either.
Well, she implicitly came out a couple, 3 years ago when, at I believe it was an awards ceremony, she thanked her longtime partner. And so she didn't really come out and say the words with a People magazine cover or anything, but she did make it clear.
So for some in the gay community, there's an obligatory responsibility here.
Yeah, right. Wanda Sykes, the stand-up comedian, has a very funny routine. She's a gay woman who's also black. And she talks about how it's difficult because you don't have to come out as black. But, you know, you don't know if a lot of folks are gay or not. And so the argument has been that somebody with that high a profile, that if they're to be trusted to relay the news, to report on things objectively, they can't be hiding their own secrets in as much. You can
I think that's absolutely bogus. That is silly to me. Just on its face, it's silly to me. Silly.
You can also look at it as in some segments, I think, of American society, it is sort of a non-issue and, you know, some people are gay, some people are not. What's the big deal? But there are parts of the country in which people are stigmatized, they're discriminated against, they're hurt, their children growing up in communities where they are bullied for being gay. And so I think that statement is a big deal for them and for those communities and for where our mores are as an entire country, not just in certain parts of society.
But again, going back to my first question to Sylvia, haven't we evolved past this point yet where this kind of announcement isn't news? Because it certainly isn't to me. I guess it just makes no ripple on my in my brain whatsoever.
I wish we were. I don't think that this country right now is. There are those who are going to be very polarized on pick an issue. And I think this is probably a chance for him to establish a line of credibility either for him or against him that's very clear now.
Yeah.
But to your point, are we past it? I think not. I think that this country is so polarized right now on so many issues that to come out is to basically say, here's where I am, like it or not.
Well, let me get our listeners involved here. What do you think? Did Anderson Cooper do the right thing, or was the whole thing just sort of a superfluous waste of time? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Let's listen to what Anderson Cooper told the Daily Beast. He said this: "It's become clear to me that by remaining silent on certain aspects of my personal life for so long, I have given some the mistaken impression that I am trying to hide something that makes me uncomfortable, ashamed, or even afraid. This is distressing because it simply is not true." So again, what do you make of that, Derek?
Well, you know, there is this impression out there that journalists should always be a blank slate and that journalists have no opinions whatsoever about the things that they're covering. Well, you know, that's silly. And I have heard journalists who have tried to make pronouncements about that. That's not true. We all have our own things that we bring to the table.
Yeah.
You could argue then that every journalist does need to then come clean about everything about their personality. I don't personally accept that. As a matter of fact, one of the things I find interesting is there are some journalists at the Star that people will talk to me about. They assume very wildly inaccurate things, like even the gender of the person. I know a lot of folks are under the impression Lee Hill Kavanaugh is male. She's not. She's a female. And so really, I think if you're doing your journalism correctly, that sort of thing should be immaterial. But again, Anderson Cooper's a little bit different because he's a personality. He's more akin to a columnist, I would agree. I would argue, even in when he's doing one of his CNN news shows.
Yeah.
You're tuning in to watch Anderson as much as you are to hear the news for a lot of people.
Okay. That's our little bit on Anderson Cooper. Let's move on here. This American Life, a program heard here on KCUR, just reported that major newspapers in Chicago, Houston, and San Francisco are among those that have acknowledged they have published dozens of items in print or online that appeared under, get this, fake bylines. The items in question were not written by reporters on the staffs of the paper at all, but by employees of what is effectively a news outsourcing firm called Journatech, if I'm saying that right. How embarrassing is that, Mike Williams?
Probably the only embarrassment, I think, is the use of the fake bylines. Why? People have been outsourcing at 100 different levels You know, we used to hire high school kids to be in the courthouse to collect the election night results and phone them in to some other kids that typed them into the system way back in the day before computers. And so, you know, people were doing things not terribly different than this at different levels forever. You know, it's what bothered me about it was that the whole fake byline thing, instead of just saying, you know, we've got people someplace collecting data online and aggregating it and putting it into the system for us, and that's that. I think that's where the hue and cry has come from, not the fact that they were actually using an outsource.
Explain for our listeners, Mike, what is Journatech?
I think it's Journatech.
Journatech? Journatech, right.
It's a company
yes.
that...
He told me that before the show, too.
Right. It's a company Journatech. That is using... a variety of people. I think they have 50, 60 employees and a whole lot of freelancers that collect factual data, aggregated, if you will, and then turn it around and provide it to newspaper companies that subscribe to that service. So, for example, they may choose to aggregate real estate transactions. And so rather than having some person in Lawrence, Kansas or Kansas City or wherever go to the courthouse, read the records, see who bought what property. Freelancers or employees of Journatech do that instead, put it into some format that is then transmitted to the local paper, and that's what they put into their columns. Hmm. And so it's not a local person who resides in Lawrence, Kansas, who drives down to the Douglas County Courthouse to look at the court records or look at the police blotter to see what happened by the police and ambulance or fire people last night. Does that make it any less factual? Probably not. The complaint has been, well, how can they be doing localized reporting if they're not local? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what the big deal has been among those who have been most critical of the service.
But I think they're not just compiling data, but also doing reporting on city council meetings and other local issues where the newspaper does not have a staff. And in this case of the Chicago Tribune, in the This American Life story, they talked about how the newspaper decided to reduce its staff of reporters in local communities, I think from 18 to 7, and in favor of picking up Journatech, and were able to do a lot more reporting, but there's question about the quality because
yeah.
those people were not in Chicago. Some of them were in the Philippines or elsewhere in the United States.
Well, if they're in the Philippines, Derek, what would anyone there know about Kansas City or Chicago or newspapers? The Star is not using Journatech, but papers that do use it. Yeah.
And that brings up to me, I think, probably one of the biggest dangers that you could have, because a reporter needs to know the context of the information that they're reporting on. And, you know, one of the most interesting things to me is when a reader comes to me with a story suggestion and I go back to somebody on the Metro desk and I say, hey, has anybody looked into this? And sometimes the answer will be, yes, well, the facts of this are true. This is exactly what happened. But the reality is this person is an outlier in the game, you know, is a nut job, is whatever. And we're not going to cover it because it doesn't really have any import. This, you know, this measure in the House has no chance of actually making it through. It's a stunt. And so those are the types of things that a reporter knows who has been covering that beat intimately and who knows mm-hmm. the players. And so this is one of the biggest casualties, I think, in the retraction of journalistic resources over the past decade, is that you simply don't have those people who have the feet on the ground in especially some of those smaller jurisdictions, because there's unfortunately not the readership for it to support the advertising to be able to put the journalism out. And so, you know, being a private enterprise, as American journalism is for the most part, that's where you're going to have a little bit of a peel back in the coverage.
And Derek, just to be clear, this is a cost-cutting move by newspapers trying to save money. This is a new way for them to do it.
Or another
way. You outsource some of this reporting work.
Or another way you could look at it is it's a way for them to provide some of that coverage that is not financially supportable according to the old model. I mean, I should be in management because that's kind of the spin that you might hear. But I mean, that is the truth. Some people really want that information. Unfortunately, whether you can really provide it on an economically viable basis is a different question.
Yeah, Sylvia.
I think it is really interesting because there does seem something to be something wrong as a journalist for thinking about somebody in the Philippines trying to cover, you know, what's happening in a suburban city council meeting. But at the same time, when you think about that fact that that kind of reporting is happening less and less and less, and it's just not there, and the newspaper industry and journalism in general is just trying to figure out how to bring that news to people. I mean, in some cases, these are communities that maybe have never been really reported on. And so how do people find out what's going on in their own town?
Well, I'm still confused, Mike Williams. If you are a reporter for Jornetic in the Philippines or in Los Angeles, for that matter, and you're writing a story about what happened at some suburban Chicago city council meeting, how are you reporting that story from so far away and lacking this context that Derek was just talking
about? Well, see, I think that's where there's not a lot of clarity about exactly what Jornetic is doing for the Chicago papers, the Houston papers that were doing it. If you look at what Jornetic says they do, they look at themselves as aggregators, not as on-the-street reporters.
So they compile
factual
online
data that is available to anybody that could, you know, anybody that can have access to the system that is reporting factual data.
Arrests or real estate transactions.
Kind of,
they're not reporting stories on what the city council
Where it gets made. Real fuzzy is when they start to do those kinds of things. You could get the transcript of the city council meeting. You know, there's somebody taking notes during the city council meeting. You could get that and you could pull together some sort of a report of this is what happened at the meeting last night. The trouble is that doesn't have the analytic formula that's at play there that a local reporter and with the context, you know, we talked about context, it doesn't bring into context what is really going on. So they decided to raise the sales tax 0.5% because of some district that they want to create in Lawrence. Well, okay, so what? That's a fact. What does it really mean? And is this a pattern that's been going on for 6 years, 10 years? That's where it falls apart.
How many papers around the country, Mike Williams, have actually hired Jornetic? Do we know roughly? A handful or 40?
I don't honestly know. It says that according to the NPR story that sort of broke this whole thing, there's about 30 papers, it said, that are using it on a regular basis, but that may not be the full extent of it.
And, Derek, do you know why the Star is not using Jornetic?
Well, I don't know, to tell you the truth. But
we're not there.
I'm not aware of any discussions about having used any service like that.
Yeah.
Similar kind of situation, though. And again, it's not Jornetic. It's not the same thing exactly. But a lot of papers, and Gannett particularly, the big corporation has 80 or 90 newspapers around the country. They're doing their copy editing at essentially copy editing ranches or farms, if you will, where the actual production of the daily newspaper is not happening in the location where it's going to be published. It's being done at a centralized location, and that's becoming a much more common acceptable thing
too, isn't it? For the same reason, a copy editor in Houston wouldn't know very much about what's going on in Chicago.
Oh,
right?
I find that to be much more troubling because ultimately, those are the last sets of eyes and the last brain cells that look at copy before it goes into print. And those are the ones that know that you spell a word this way or that way, that you pronounce it this way or that way if it's an on-air kind of story. And I think that's where the quality of the journalism will and has started to fail.
Yeah.
And that's a huge problem.
To wind this back up to how we began this section on Jornetic with talking about fake bylines. So where do the fake bylines come from that have been associated now with Jornetic? What happened there? Anybody?
Oh, I think it's the same thing that we've had with outsourcing for a long time, where you pick your phone company to complain about your bill, and you get someone with a very foreign-sounding accent who has a name of Sally Jones. And it's clear from the sound of the voice, and it sounds like it's a long-distance phone call.
Her name is probably not Sally Jones.
She's probably not Sally Jones. And when you ask, oh, yes, I'm in wherever, I think it's an effort to try to make it feel more comfortable for those receiving that information, but it's totally bogus. And anybody that has half an ounce of sense is going to realize it's fake. And anytime you layer anything fake on news, you're in trouble.
You're asking for trouble. And in response to this, then, some newspapers like the Chicago Tribune have dropped Jornetic, right?
Right.
Okay. So the fate of Jornetic sort of hangs in the balance as we speak here, perhaps.
Well, I think what will happen is it will perhaps retrench a bit and go back into the aggregation format that it probably was intended to be in the first place.
Yeah.
But I think the concept of looking to technology and looking to modern business practices to find some solutions to the questions facing local news, yeah. as much as this makes me feel uncomfortable, it just seems like more ideas need to be out there and tried to figure out how to get the local news to people who don't know what's going on in their community.
Because the bottom line is, as you know as well as I, it costs money to produce news, right?
Yeah, but there
Casey
are some
Kearns
ideas.
Every week and everything else.
You know,
yeah.
there are some ideas. Technology does make certain things cheaper, and there's some innovative ideas out there. I think that some of the things we're going to be talking about a little bit later, too, that can make this possible, but they're journalistic questions involved.
And I think that Sylvia really brings up an interesting point about that coverage. People have, I think, a very mistaken impression that this is something that all major newspapers have always done throughout their history. Well, folks, you don't have to go back very far at all to look back at the Star's microfilm from the 80s and before. The suburbs did not exist for the major metropolitan dailies. You know, in the 90s, and particularly the late 90s, all newspapers around the country had a huge explosion of these community editions that they went out and aggressively tried to cover some of these small local governments that had never really seen any kind of coverage except in some of those smaller local papers that no longer exist. Again, a casualty of the economy and of the web. And so the Star at one point had, I believe it was 13 or 15 different neighborhood news editions, and you know now there are four. Because the economic model just did not hold out. And so that was new coverage at that time in the very, very richest days probably ever of the newspaper industry.
So we are at a point then, Derek, you're saying, where there are some communities around the country that maybe many communities that simply are not being covered by newspapers any longer.
Well, certainly not by the major metropolitan dailies, but that's where you say, well, that's where, you know, the citizen journalists maybe come in.
Yeah.
One of the J schools, journalism schools out in Washington State, did a recent study, the Murrow School, and they found that in a state, Washington State, where Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, the biggest internet companies that are there and providing as much information as anybody, that state is one of the worst in the country in being able to provide news to most of the residents of that state because you've got four TV stations. Basically in Seattle and down the west side of the state. There are 23 daily newspapers for a state the size of Kansas, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so a huge portion of that population has no internet because they're way out in the middle of nowhere. They have no broadband, so they don't get the web. And they're not getting any information. And so that school has discovered this pressing need, this huge need to find some other way to report local news for these communities that don't have anything.
And that's our next topic here as we turn to citizen journalists. Let me just tell our listeners, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're visiting with our media critics. They are KU journalism prof Mike Williams, Kansas City Star Reader's Rep Derek Donovan, and Sylvia Maria Gross, a host and producer of KC Currents, heard here every Sunday afternoon at 5. As always, if you want to join our conversation, you can do it. 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Let's turn to that whole notion of citizen journalists. There is this new push on, as Mike just said, to hire citizen journalists to counter the spread of information ghettos, they're called, where ready information about public institutions is not readily available. Miami Herald columnist Leonard Pitts wrote last month that citizen journalists cannot replace professionals. But that new report that Mike just mentioned from the Washington State University's Moreau College of Communication suggests we should be doing just that. Citizen journalists, that makes sense to you, Sylvia?
Well, I think I have mixed feelings about it as a journalist,
yeah.
you know, who went to school and learned how to do this and you know, does it full time and believes it's a profession.
Yeah.
So,
as
you know, it takes a skill to not just, you know, report something that somebody said, but actually find out what you know, some of the truth is behind a situation and get many perspectives on it and analyze data. Put that all together in a way that is going to be engaging and interesting for people so that they'll actually read it is a skill, and not everybody can do it or is trained to do it.
You know, I was going to say, at my first newspaper in Freeport, Illinois, your first task in the morning was to take the reports from citizen journalists who covered many of the small towns around Freeport. You know, neat people, great people, but when it came to stringing facts together in some coherent manner and avoiding libelous, you know, slander and everything else in their reports, man, it, you know, you do need another set of eyes on what those folks are putting out, Derek.
And, well, and I think that journalism has to be a collaborative process with layers. I mean, that is the traditional model that everybody learns, is that no one person should be able to release anything unfettered. And you want to have those checks and balances throughout the process. And that's the thing that I worry about, especially a lot of the early bloggers. You know, Jeff Jarvis is a guy who has basically been turning cartwheels every time a mainstream journalist has been laid off over the past 10 years, because he's been saying what a great thing it is that we don't have to have these institutions anymore. Well, Jeff Jarvis made his name through a mainstream institution. He came up through the world of mainstream entertainment journalism. So it's very easy for those people to tisk-tisk after they've basically already made their names and fortunes through that checks and balances system. And then, okay, they can hold forth themselves. But you have to remember that you got to have an editor asking you questions, no matter who the reporter is. Mm-hmm. And great reporters get challenged and also get caught in mistakes by the copy desk, by all sorts of people.
Hey, quit looking at me while you're saying that. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Grover from Midtown, Kansas City. Good morning.
I guess my question is, why do we need newspapers or reporters anymore when you get it firsthand on Facebook and Twitter and what have you, where it's unfiltered?
Well, a lot of times those reports you're seeing on Facebook and Twitter are from newspapers, though, right, Grover?
No, it's a personal statement. It's a firsthand statement instead of going through a filter. So you don't have an interpretation of a reporter or an editor or someone else. You've got it. You know, you're getting it, you know, straight from the horse's mouth, as they used to say.
Mike,
it's unadulterated. It's unabridged.
Well, I would agree with the notion that without filters, you should be able to make your own decisions. And we talked about context earlier this morning, and I think that's where the role of the professional journalist still comes into play. Is this person's tweet about something may be directly opposite of what the next person's tweet about something, and in the middle of that is probably where the truth actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And so by having a layer of professionalism on top of all of this information that's flowing around freely, you do help people bring some focus to what's being said. And whether you believe that the media is trying to be unbiased or not, the fact is they're at least trying to bring some focus and context to what's out there.
What do you think, Grover? Maybe Grover left. Let's go back to some calls. Mike from Shawnee. Mike, good morning to you. Just, I think Mike has the opposite opinion here. Mike, good morning.
Oh, yeah, I do. I've made my living in the cable TV business, but I'm very concerned about the loss of subscribers to newspapers. I mean, our republic was founded. In fact, it wouldn't have been founded without the free press. And the founding fathers thought it so important that they embodied the free press in the Second Amendment to the Constitution. It is not the newspaper. It's not the Star's fault that the Star is small in number of pages and sections as it used to be. And whenever I hear somebody say, well, look at this, it's hardly, you know, I just launch myself at them, because it's not the newspaper's fault. If you don't subscribe to it, hell, they can't afford to keep the staff that they used to have. I could ramble on, but my one modest little suggestion for the Star is, if a parent or grandparent would be willing to buy subscriptions for their children, adult children or grandchildren, and do consolidated billing, that is, I'd pay for all of it with my monthly bill, the Star ought to offer a very deeply discounted, you know, multiple subscription rate. Because I think my kids, if they would get the Star for a year, it would become so embodied in their daily life they would keep it on their own. But, you know, it is really important. Who's gonna watch out for the city council, the crooks, and the and the state legislatures, who's going to do this? Not some guy sitting at a desk in the Philippines, I can assure you that.
Yeah.
I mean, we are not going to be able to keep our republic without a vibrant and vital and profitable free press.
Mike, I should just keep you on for the whole hour, Mike. You are singing my tune. Derek, to what extent is this idea of citizen journalists the future of American journalism, do you think?
Well, you know, people have been saying that this was going to be the next big thing ever since the invention of portable tape recorders and since the invention of portable video recorders. You know, this death knell for professional journalism has been sounded many times throughout the years. Yeah, I think that this kind of goes back to Sylvia's point that no matter what the task that's being done, there are going to be some great amateurs out there. There's no question. But somebody who's going to professionalize it, who is going to undertake it as their enterprise, that they also have codified codes of ethics and the types of things that traditional journalism has today, is always going to give you, again, I keep coming back to that idea of the checks and balances.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have seen a lot of good journalism that's out there that has been done by individuals. But at the same time, kind of going back to our previous caller's question about just getting it straight from the person's Facebook page. Well, talk about two people who – one of whom was bitten by the other person's dog. Go read their accounts on their individual Facebook pages of what really happened. Oh, that interloper was in my yard. Oh, well, that dog's been dangerous since the day they came in. That's the kind of thing that if you're approaching that as a journalist, you're going to realize there are multiple ways of looking at it. And so you report what those people say, but neither one of them necessarily is gospel.
Where do you want your local news to come from? That's our topic, 816-235-2888. Sylvia?
I do think that there is a big role for citizen, and I don't know if journalist is the right term that we've come up with, but for people to contribute. And the way the internet has given so many more people a voice and a way to communicate with journalists and with each other just to crowdsource these ideas. I mean, I think that you can come across as a journalist so many more ideas than you might have come across previously. And of course, filter them and learn from them. But that there is a role, and I think that reporters have and need to, and news organizations in general find ways to harness that. I mean, we do it on our Facebook page when we ask, like, who's had this experience to look for people to write about. Finding the right role for citizens to participate in the news gathering process, I think, is key.
Mike,
I think to simplify that, it does bring a diversity to the breadth of voice that you get in the media, and that's the best part of the aspect of it. So
let's go back to some calls here. And Richard from Kansas City, Missouri, welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the topic.
Sure.
That other caller kind of touched on it for me in that reporting is supposed to be more than recording. You're not just supposed to hold a microphone.
That's right.
Or turn on a recorder. Or sometimes in the mainstream media, even people that are supposed to be journalists, they're basically just, you know, saying, well, that's Senator A's opinion and that's Senator B's opinion, instead of really challenging. It's supposed to be journalism. And civilians may be able to do that sometimes, but reporters are supposed to do it all the time.
Right.
I mean, that's what they went to J school for, right?
That's right, Richard. You got it right. Thank you for the call.
Well, thanks.
Let's go to J.R. from Midtown. J.R., you're on Up to Date.
Good morning, all. Real good topic today.
Thank you.
Basically, I had a little bit of journalistic training in school, but didn't follow that path to a career. But my thesis is that no matter who is the reporter, the reporting party, whether it's a citizen journalist or a professional journalist, all things reported, no matter whether it's a video that they put up on YouTube or a written report for something like the Wall Street Journal, filtered to their own biases and perceptions. Take a look at the Supreme Court decision on affordable health care. The two cable news channels jumped off the wrong end, and everybody else was kind of a little funny, and it took a while for it to really shake out to what it was.
Yeah, right. JR, thank you
all
for
their perception.
Yeah, thank you for the call. And let's just jump into that using JR's comments as a springboard into our final comment here with our critics this morning. What happened a couple of weeks ago when CNN and Fox News got the news so wrong when it came to reporting on what the U.S. Supreme Court was saying about the individual mandate, which, of course, was the key, is the key component of the president's new health care plan? Both those networks at first said the court had thrown out the mandate, which, of course, wasn't the case. What happened there, Derek?
I think we've got a Twitter tragedy here, and it's something that is becoming a really amped up, ridiculous thing, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Look, every news organization in the world thinks they need to break all news on Twitter these days. You know, that's what the current fad is, and it is a fad. I don't care what anybody says. If you are all using Twitter in 5 years, I'll buy every listener at this radio station.
Is that right?
That's my personal opinion.
Yeah.
These things have a very short shelf life. How many people still remember their MySpace logins?
But people want to be first on Twitter.
Right, and that is a big mania right now. But the thing is, I don't know how many people you have in your Twitter feed, particularly those that have something to do with the news. But within 5 minutes of that news breaking, I bet I had 50 alerts from everything in the world, from you know, from Emporia to the Kansas City Star to CNN to mm-hmm. the BBC, all reporting this stuff. Everybody reports that on Twitter. Who cares if you have it 3 seconds before one of your quote-unquote competitors?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is this kind of classic argument of the things you can win, the things you can own, and the things that you just have to participate in.
Yeah.
Everybody in the journalism field has to participate
That's
in Twitter
point.
And breaking news.
Great point.
But why on earth should, you know, the Kansas City Star worry about being the first one to break that story? In other words, what the Star ought to be doing is talking about how that affects Kansas City. And that is something that takes a lot longer than composing a tweet.
So you think CNN and Fox News simply jumped too quick? They thought they had the information right, and they simply had it wrong.
I don't have
trying
a,
to
I,
be first.
I don't have a crystal ball. I wasn't in the newsrooms. I guarantee you, they had two different tweets composed and ready to go. Actually, probably three, because they say it was overturned, it was upheld, or it was a split decision, and somebody just pressed the wrong button and sent the wrong one.
It happens.
It was actually interesting. There's a transcript of the second by second play of how this played out at the Supreme Court. And what happened was the mandate was being considered under two different laws, the Commerce Clause and whether it was a tax. And under the Commerce Clause, which was the first on the first page of the report, the release from the Supreme Court, the court found that no, it didn't fit under the Commerce Clause, which is basically then somebody took a breath at that point. Well, that's what CNN, that's what Fox heard, said, oh, they've overturned it because of the Commerce Clause that they found it wasn't, you know, constitutional under. So that's what spun their wheels into action. The next page, literally, I'm sure took the time it took somebody to take a breath. It went in and said, oh, yes, but under the tax clause, it absolutely is a tax, and it can be accepted under that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in that very brief – it wasn't even a minute's worth of time in the breakdown. That's what happened. But once the wheels got spinning at CNN and Fox, you know, things were in motion.
Well, by day's end, there were people out there who had composed sort of a faux picture of – Harry Truman holding up a newspaper, and instead of saying, you know, Dewey beats Truman, it was Supreme Court strikes down health care law, which, of course, wasn't the case.
Well, and there were denial of services. In other words, the Supreme Court's website was inaccessible because so many people were trying to hit it to get the information. And so it was just one of those perfect storms, to use a cliche, of too many things happening too fast, and the process just fell apart.
Kate from Prairie Village, you're on Up to Date with our media critics. Kate, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling because of the comment made by a previous caller about the value of getting our information from Facebook or Twitter.
Right.
That was a really scary comment to me. You know, I think as consumers of information, it's our responsibility to evaluate the source of that information. And Facebook and Twitter is essentially anecdotal information. There's no peer review. There's no fact-checking. And although news media resource or sources do make mistakes, make errors because they don't do appropriate fact-checking, I still think the quality of that source is much, much higher, certainly, than something that we would get off of Facebook and Twitter. And news organizations make mistakes when they rely on this essentially anecdotal report based off Twitter not giving enough time for fact-checking. And I think I'm really concerned about the fact that we're kind of losing our ability to think critically about the information we're consuming as a society. And so I just wanted to make that comment.
Okay, we have a future together, Kate. Derek, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting comment. The letters to the editor page in any newspaper is, you know, you could argue it's been Facebook for, you know, 120 years.
Oh.
And I worked on the letters page at the Star for 8 years, and I got to tell you, there's great ideas that come in from readers all the time, but the fact-checking on the letters to the editor page is one of the most onerous things that is done in a newspaper. And very often you can pull a good point out of a letter that has libel in it, out of a letter that has erroneous facts. And so you're right, and that is one of the responsibilities when you are a professional journalist, is that you've got to basically filter the wheat from the chaff.
Okay, one more caller here. Let's go to Dale from Kansas City, Kansas. Dale, good morning.
Good morning. I was going to make a quick point, I think, on the downsizing of the actual newspaper. Is, in my opinion, one of the reasons is the excessive debt burden that so many of the papers created when they started doing all the purchasing of each other and the different corporations owning them. Therefore, to pay it off, they had to eliminate quite a few staff.
Mm-hmm.
So the subscriptions are an issue, but when you're up to your eyebrows in debt, that's another problem.
Dale, I think you're laying out an accurate concern there. And we are out of time this morning with our media critics. I want to thank Kansas City Star Readers Rep Derek Donovan, KU Journalism Professor Mike Williams, and Sylvia Maria Gross, a host and producer of KC Currents, heard here every Sunday afternoon at 5. Thank you all very much for your time. Always good to have you guys.
Thank you.